part of this attack. It's been very widely reported, but this is the first time officially it's being said by an Israeli official. He talks about Israeli soldiers being...
Wow, and from there, from that report, Julia, it went on like fire, eating up digital media, especially a lot of newspapers and very well-known websites talking about these claims that there was a mass rape and that Netanyahu himself was talking to Biden and telling him about it. Those are strong allegations.
They are strong allegations, but it's funny how they came to be resurfaced in Western media months after they weren't reported on in those same outlets and in those same sources, which we'll talk about in a little bit before. And of course, they go in these allegations without any evidence, just to reinforce a certain connotation on what Palestinians do, what Arab men are like, in order to justify this genocide that's happening against Gaza. Mm-hmm. So moving on from here, we had renowned Western press like the New York Times printing pieces like how Hamas weaponized sexual violence on October 7th as late as December 28th, claiming that the mass rape story was verified based on just one line that says, Israeli police officials said that they believed Ms. Abdush was raped.
I think we have an updated zoom on this article. If you can see the second one where there's that's what you're talking about, basically, where the Israeli police officials said that they believed that Mr. Abdush was raped, and she has become a symbol of horrors visited upon Israeli women and girls. Wow, they believe.
They said that they believed.
So we should believe what they believe?
What Israeli police believe. The same Israeli police that spread the 40 beheaded babies.
That's beyond what basically journalism is. I mean, the 101 classes of journalism has been shattered with these believe and unverified documents. But do you think that that's like talking like, we're talking about the New York Times here. I think that is a big deal, Julia. If the New York Times is ready to lie without having any evidence, don't you think?
It's not the first time the New York Times lied without any evidence. And unfortunately, mainstream media is doing this constantly because right now the objective is to kind of support Israel at all costs. Mm-hmm. And the ends justify the means to Western governments and Western press that they can give full range for the Zionist entity to... you know, say whatever it is to basically continue the military, the joint military and political objectives of the U.S. and Israel.
And New York Times was not alone in it, was it?
It wasn't. So another piece here by CNN published on January 4th says that one witness claims Hamas fighters laughed as they raped and murdered a woman in Israel on October 7th.
It's important that the world hear from witnesses. While you were hiding out that day, hiding from Hamas, you saw five of these terrorists, pulling a young woman out of a van. Tell us what you saw next.
I hide in the bush, and 30 meters from the bush, I saw a white van that arrived near the bush. And from the van, five civilians is from Gaza. Normal civilians, is not soldiers from Nukba's soldiers. It was regular people from Gaza with normal clothes, and they started to pull their clothes off. It was like half a circle, and the girl was in the middle of the circle, and after they pulled the clothes off of the girl, they started to one of them started to rape her, and it was something like 30 seconds.
Wow. You hear how, first of all, he said he believes civilians and not Hamas fighters were the ones that committed the act. Of course, it looks obviously like he's just trying to pull a story that's not there. So there's no evidence that, even from his account, if you're to take it at face value, that Hamas ever did that. And we don't even know who these supposed civilians were that committed this, in case the story ever had a shred of truth to it. Mm-hmm. So inside the article, after presenting this entire story without evidence, CNN writes that CNN cannot independently verify Cohen's account. So Cohen, the guy who was giving this interview, mm-hmm. the guy who was being interviewed, he actually gave a interview to I-24, the Zionist entity news website, just days after this, where none of this was mentioned.
Wow.
By the way, so it's obvious it's just.
So he's changing the story as well.
He's changing the story. He's bringing up new information without evidence, and there's some sources that also shown that he's an IDF soldier too. Mm-hmm. So
it's even different than the introduction that was given by the CNN reporter or the CNN anchor. And
Then
he says that it wasn't Hamas, it was regular civilians. And then later on a different TV channel, he says that none of this actually happened. There was another third story that he was telling. So that tells you a lot about horrible lies that are being spread, especially on digital media. I mean, if you go to the website of CNN, I'm pretty sure that this kind of story is a story that is promoted, that is being put on the first page for the people to see, and that's a bit scary,
exactly.
Isn't it? I want to thank you very much, Ms. Julia Qasim, for being with us, and I wonder just what kind of horrible lies the social media segment now has for us. Off to social media, ladies and gents. Israeli entity officials and supporters have been putting out false and contradictory statements in an effort to deny responsibility for an airstrike that killed hundreds of Palestinians in the Al Ahli Arab Hospital in Gaza City on Tuesday, October 17. But the attempts at spin have quickly come apart. Here with us is Sima Itayim, social media expert, to reveal how the Zionists admitted to being behind the massacre, then quickly changing the story. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having
Sima,
me.
How did it all start?
Well, let's have this first tweet as an example. Ali Abu Nima of the Electronic Intifada pointed out that the Israeli government account on Twitter, now called X, posted and then quickly deleted a video that it said supported the occupation army's claim that the hospital had actually been hit by a misfired Palestinian rocket.
Mm-hmm.
The timestamp actually exposed a half-hour time gap. It was half an hour after the bomb exploded at the hospital.
Wow.
And so the occupation forces quickly edited out the video and kept the tweet. But the internet is forever, and we have those receipts now.
Oh.
Can't hide.
And there you go. We have that screenshot showing us that the timestamp there is just different from what happened, or the time that the airstrike happened, and they blatantly just deleted it, and we're supposed to just X-Men, just, you know?
Right.
That camera that deletes our memory,
right.
That's not here in real life. Well, let's go to the second tweet.
Yeah, so this, in its edited current version, the tweet still tries to make that same claim and blame a misfired rocket launched by the Islamic Jihad, which is the second biggest resistance group in the Gaza Strip.
Mm-hmm.
But the video has been removed. People were quick to notice.
Mm-hmm. So they also removed another video that they supposedly were claiming that the Islamic Jihad did that bombing, and then that video also was fake.
Correct.
Wow. Now the third tweet.
Right, that same account actually later posted footage from an Al Jazeera broadcast mm-hmm. claiming that it showed the moment that the Islamic Jihad launched a rocket which misfired and hit the hospital, killing hundreds.
So you have that video? Can
let's
we
watch
see
that video.
Wow,
together.
Let's see that video.
بلغ عن إصابات في صفوف الإسرائيليين ونحن نشير إلى أن هذه المدينة هي الأكثر تعرضا للصواريخ منذ بداية هذه الحرب. عمدة المدينة كانت تحدث قبل.
This video was supposedly shot by Al Jazeera, but it was not from the area, but they claimed it was from the area?
Correct. So, it was the same account putting out another video. Maybe the other attempt had failed. I don't know. But people were once again quick to notice
mm-hmm.
and point out that the rocket being launched was too far away from the site
from
of the strike.
From the Al-Ahli Baptist Hospital.
And mm-hmm. that's aside from the fact that the blast couldn't have physically caused, mm-hmm. been caused by Palestinian weapons. They, mm-hmm. they can't inflict that kind of damage. And we know that. There's another thing. There's also another time gap of 50 minutes.
Wow.
So that was another thing that...
Between the timing of the video
yes.
and the actual airstrike on Al-Ahli.
Right.
Wow.
So that was too much of a gap between the two incidents, and people had, were once again questioning, you know, why are you still lying?
But questioning now is anti-Semitic, Seema. Be careful.
That's true. We have to be careful.
And then we have maybe another tweet.
Yeah, we have another tweet by a Zionist Israeli media personality with 1.5 million followers on Facebook and 500K on Twitter. Hananiah Naftali, he's actually the army spokesman.
Wow.
Not just an influencer or personality. And he reported minutes after the strike on Al-Ahli Hospital that the Israeli Air Force did indeed hit what he called a Hamas terrorist base inside a hospital in Gaza. And he went on to claim that Hamas had been launching rockets from hospitals, mosques, and schools and was using civilians as human shields. All Hasbara talking points that have repeatedly been debunked over the past 3 months.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But then yet again, that tweet disappeared.
It did disappear, but it stayed on his Telegram channel. He quickly deleted it off of Twitter.
So he deleted it on ex-Twitter, but he kept
it on Telegram.
And then later on, he said that the Israeli occupation forces, they don't bomb any hospitals.
Right.
No. We didn't see other hospitals like Al-Shifa
right.
Hospital or Sur Hospital or other hospitals all across the Gaza Strip being hit. And it's just ridiculously unprofessional media to report about this, ridiculously unprofessional by those spokesperson that you just showed us, Mr. Naftali himself, who has at least millions of followers, whether on Twitter or on other social media. And they still claim to be the most moral army in the world, Seema.
Right.
That's...
They
beyond
do.
Horrific. I want to thank you very much, Seema, for your time and effort
You're
to
welcome.
Show us the tweets and the social media fabrications. Now, ladies and gents, please stay tuned because next we will be talking about figures expose. Now, over half of young Americans surveyed on Zionist Israel's war on Gaza believe the Zionist state should cease to exist and instead be replaced by a Palestinian entity, according to an online poll conducted in December 2023. The monthly Harvard CAPS Harris poll found continuing support for Zionist Israel in its campaign against Hamas among every age demographic but 18 to 24 years old. Overall, the survey found that 81% of respondents do actually back Zionist Israel. However, among the youngest age bracket, though they support, is evenly split between Zionist Israel and the Palestinians. On several questions, voters in that age group seem to express contradicting or, let's say, muddled views. For instance, despite 51% replying in the affirmative when asked if Zionist Israel should be ended and given to Hamas and the Palestinians, we saw that 58% of respondents in the group also thought Hamas should be removed from running Gaza. However, most of the entire pool of respondents, that's 60%, preferred a two-state solution to the ongoing conflict. At the same time, we saw that 60% think that the October 7 attacks were justified by Palestinian grievances, although 63% of all respondents answered that Zionist Israel was trying to defend itself with its military offensive aimed at supposedly eliminating Hamas from Gaza. 60% of 18 to 24-year-olds said that the Zionist Israeli campaign constitutes genocide against the people of Gaza. Very interesting figures indeed. Now, let us end off with the most notable voices from TikTok during and after South Africa dragged Zionist Israel to the International Court of Justice. For Exposé Voices, the loudest last week was that of Adila Hassim, a prominent South African lawyer who recently captured international attention with her compelling representation of South Africa at the International Court of Justice, ICJ. During the opening arguments, Adila emphasized the severity of the Israeli entity's brutal onslaught on Gaza, describing it as one of the heaviest conventional bombing campaigns in modern warfare history. Here's Adila's voice.
For the past 96 days, Israel has subjected Gaza to what has been described as one of the heaviest conventional bombing campaigns in the history of modern warfare. Palestinians in Gaza are being killed by Israeli weaponry and bombs from air, land, and sea. They are also at immediate risk of death by starvation, dehydration, and disease as a result of the ongoing siege by Israel, the destruction of Palestinian towns, the insufficient aid being allowed through to the Palestinian population, and the impossibility of distributing this limited aid while bombs fall. This conduct renders essentials to life unobtainable. Genocides are never declared in advance. But this court has the benefit of the past 13 weeks of evidence that shows incontrovertibly a pattern of conduct and related intention that justifies a plausible claim of genocidal act.
Ladies and gents, we conclude now the first episode of Exposé. Stay tuned for more eye-opening investigations on Exposé. The truth is just a revelation away. Thank you.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of a guide for managers based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. And we are currently focusing on the 53rd letter of Imam Ali alayhi salam, which was a letter he wrote to Malik Ashtar, who was chosen as a governor for Egypt. And he had a very powerful managerial position. And Imam Ali alayhi salam gives him some basic principles for choosing the right individuals into his task force. And there he mentions various criteria. Amongst them was one we mentioned previously, that they should be from min ahli al-buyutat as-salihah, that they should be from religious families, from families that are good, known for goodness and religiousness and their adherence to the right path. You should choose from those families. Today we'll discuss another one of those criteria, whereby Imam Ali alayhi salam says wal qadami bil Islam al mutaqaddima, that they should be people who are early or have a precedence in becoming Muslims, in getting into the fold of Islam.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam mentions another very important criterion with regards to who to choose in the task force or in the managerial team or in the executive body of the government process. And he says that choose those people who have a precedence in becoming Muslims, or those who entered into the fold of Islam at an earlier stage, or they have a longer period in terms of entering into Islam. So if you know, at that time in Egypt, it was only like maybe 40-50 years since Islam was proclaimed, at the time when Imam Ali alayhi salam took the reins, around, you can say, 40 or 50 Hijra, which is now very early stages of Islam. It's not like today that, you know, we have people who are Muslims generations to generations, like hundreds years, 500 years, even 1,000 years. People, some people are like that, like they have lived, they are the product of generations of Islam. But at that time, no, it wasn't like that. Like, Islam had just begun, and Imam Ali alayhi salam had taken the leadership. And therefore, there are people, for example, who became Muslims at a very early stage, and there are people who had come at a later stage. At a later stage, we mean people who had no choice, in a way. They didn't have a very, you can say, intellectually based reason for becoming Muslims. But they felt, for example, that they had no choice, or they felt that there was no chance of doing a coup, or they had to, you know, submit to the grandeur of Islam and the power with which it was expanding. So there were people like that, while there were others who were at the very onset, when Islam was at its weakest, when there were very few people, Islam was vulnerable, Muslims were vulnerable, that's when they became Muslims. And that is a sign that these people were more adherent, and their decisions were more intellectual, and they had a firm basis behind why they became Muslims. Of course, this is not a general principle. When Imam Ali alayhi salam says that choose those that became Muslims at an earlier stage and they have a history of Islam in them, that doesn't mean that all of them are good, or all those who became Muslims later are bad, or they shouldn't be chosen. No, this is just a general principle that could be used as a criterion when you are choosing someone to have authority.
IRIB English Radio presents a detailed commentary of the Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him, on the program Gate of Knowledge.
Now, as I mentioned, the basic issue behind this is that this person that you want to put into power, and you want him to have this authority, or you want him to execute and handle very, very important and sensitive issues in the government, do you want him to be a person who truly doesn't have those values that you are trying to portray, or those that you're trying to impart into the community? The issue is that they have to have those values really in depth in their hearts. And one of the ways is to find out how they became Muslims, and when they became Muslims, and under what circumstances they became Muslims. If they became Muslims because of fear, or because of force, or because of some political maneuvering, then these do not have the true adherence to take forward the movement that you want to start. But it's because of some political considerations that they have done so. While there are those that have true and real adherence. Now, it is possible that at that time, when Imam Ali alayhi salam was giving Malik Ashtar these commandments and these criteria, it is possible that there were individuals that became Muslims at a later stage, but had that criteria, had that criterion of being adherent and using their really, truly intellectual reasoning for doing something or becoming Muslims. Yes, those could be used. But this is like a quick general principle to show you that, look, if you are stuck sometimes and you don't know, then it is easier for you to choose someone who has got a history in that direction, who has been weather-beaten in this field, and has truly shown his loyalty towards that direction. This is what Imam Ali alayhi salam is trying to tell us with this phrase. Let us pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that we are able to truly understand the statements to our capacity of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. And this is our understanding, but Allah is the best of knowers. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
In the limelight.
At least 10 other countries quickly followed the United States, including the UK and Germany, in pausing aid to Palestinians. This group of historic and present-day offenders has now been dubbed the axis of genocide. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. The Electronic Intifada wrote, "The Zionist regime has killed more than 150 UNRWA employees since October 7th. That onslaught did not lead the US or Israel's European allies to stop providing the Zionist regime with support and military assistance. But the child killer regime of Israel's dubiously timed allegations that 12 UNRWA employees were involved in armed activity quickly led at least 11 countries to suspend their UNRWA contributions. Notably, there has been no hue and cry over Israeli teachers and tech workers taking part in a genocidal Israeli military assault on Gaza. UNRWA did not comment on a question from the Electronic Intifada as to whether Lot Sereni had called for criminal prosecution of those Israeli troops and politicians involved in the killing of UNRWA personnel. Nor did the agency comment on a question as to how many of the more than 10,000 Palestinian children killed by the Zionist regime's assault had attended UNRWA schools. Lot Sereni has used the word abhorrent to describe the Palestinian military assault that began on October 7th. The agency did not comment on a question as to what terminology Lotzerini applies to the Zionist regime's genocidal policies against Palestinians in Gaza. Julia Tuma, director of communications for UNRWA, emailed the Electronic Intifada that there is a UN investigation taking place, and as long as that's happening, I'm not able to provide any more information on the allegations or the UN investigation. No comment on which court Lotzerini had in mind for possible criminal prosecution of UNRWA employees, including, possibly, the two-tier Israeli legal system was forthcoming. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, like Lotzerini, has called for possible criminal prosecution of UN employees. Stefan Dojarik, spokesperson of the Secretary General, said that we have no further comment on that topic, referring to the location of the court and whether criminal prosecution could take place in an Israeli court. UNRWA is certainly in a delicate position, desperate as it is to keep donor support to avoid running out of money in February. That cutoff would come in the middle of the worst crisis to hit Gaza since 1948 Nakba, when some 800,000 Palestinians fled Zionist militias for Gaza, the West Bank, and elsewhere in the region. But cowering before supporters of Israel's genocide has quickly shown itself to be a losing strategy. One of the International Court of Justice orders was for humanitarian aid to be increased in Gaza, yet the US, Germany, and the UK have responded by actually cutting off humanitarian aid. Whether the ICJ will respond to this remains to be seen. With the Biden administration imperiling humanitarian aid via UNRWA, former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi targeted ceasefire demonstrators during a Sunday interview with CNN's Dana Bash, perhaps the network's leading anti-Palestinian anchor. Upset about anti-genocide protesters outside her home, Pelosi sought to blame Russian President Vladimir Putin. Pelosi claimed, "But for them to call for a ceasefire is Mr. Putin's message. Make no mistake, this is directly connected to what he would like to see, something with Ukraine. It's about Putin's message. I think some of those protesters are spontaneous and organic and sincere. Some, I think, are connected to Russia. And I say that having looked at this for a long time now, as you know." This came as news to many. Pelosi's rant is pushing more Democrats toward the exits, a process already underway with black pastors urging President Joe Biden toward a ceasefire. In October, however, Pelosi claimed protesters should go back to China, apparently basing her comments on an August 2023 hit piece by the New York Times against Code Pink, the organization, a grassroots organization working to end U.S. warfare and imperialism, pushed back against the newspaper's attack by posting solidarity statements on its website. Media Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink, told the Electronic Intifada, "Pelosi's accusations that protesters against Israel's genocide are Russian assets who should be pursued by the FBI is grotesque and a slap in the face of the millions of Americans who, at great personal cost, have been trying to stop Israel's slaughter." She added, If anyone has taken funds to support a foreign government, it is not pro-Palestinian protesters, but officials like Nancy Pelosi, who are in the pocket of Israel lobbyists. Officials such as Pelosi, she asserted, should be investigated, not those of us who want to stop the killing of innocent Palestinians. Democrats from Biden to Pelosi are ignoring the first rule of being in a hole. Stop digging. The octogenarians in the party, however, seem incapable of reversing policies alienating key constituencies. Yet, newer, younger House leaders, such as Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries, seem determined to cling to the same policies as their Democratic predecessors, infuriating the political base. It's a recipe for core constituencies to stay home in November. Many Democratic politicians have effectively thrown in their lot with the Zionist regime's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and, by extension, his ultra-right-wing coalition partners, who want to expel Palestinians from Gaza and rebuild illegal settlements there. The complicity in genocide, Francis Boyle pointed to, runs deeper and deeper with each passing day. The costs are rising for Biden, both in the region and at home. He was repeatedly warned about the Zionist regime's genocidal actions, yet chose to double down in support of the Zionist regime's war crimes and its right-wing government. For her efforts, his leading Democratic congressional critic, Rashida Tlaib, was censured by her colleagues, including some in her own party. Biden co-owns this genocide with Netanyahu and has full responsibility for the American casualties resulting from his pursuit of empire and refusal to say no to the Zionist regime's prime minister.
The very first revolution that started with the people, continued with the people, did not change its word, did not change its way, did not decrease or increase its goals, is the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei.
I'm Fatah Masumi, and this is Simorgh, a special edition dedicated to the 42nd Fajr International Film Festival. But first off, let's see what Simorgh means.
It is the most prestigious cinematic award in Iran, the Crystal Seymour. Over the past 42 years, more than 800 Crystal Seymours have been doled out, and gold and silver Seymour statuettes have been awarded to foreign movies. But what is this mysterious bird, and how did it find its way to become the symbol of Iran's most prestigious cinematic event? The Seymour is a mystical flying creature in Iranian mythology. It is regarded as a symbol of benevolence, generosity, and wisdom. And this is exactly what inspired veteran Iranian graphics designer Ibrahim Hariri, tasked with designing a logo for the Fajr Film Festival and a trophy to be awarded as the top prize.
Creating a symbol for the Fajr Film Festival was assigned to me back in 1986. First, I designed a logo. After a couple of brainstorming sessions with the organizers of the festival and listening to their ideas, I thought that the Persian mythical bird Seymour captures the concept they were looking for the best. They wanted a unique symbol that would encompass Iranian culture. On the other hand, I realized that many of the top film festivals have chosen an animal as their symbol, such as the Golden Bear of the Berlin International Film Festival or the Golden Lion of the Venice Film Festival. So, this is what inspired me to pick the Persian mythical bird Seymour. Then, in order to come up with the design, I did some extensive research in ancient Iranian drawings, and finally, the Seymour logo that you see today was created. The next year, in 1987, I designed a prize. So, in 1987, the first crystal Seymours were awarded to the winners.
Symbolizing prestige, the Seymour designed by Ibrahim Hariri is one of the most recognized logos in Iran and adorns every poster and any item related to the Fajr Film Festival. And the crystal Seymour itself is the most sought-after prize in Iran's film industry, with international independent filmmakers also vying for the statuette of the mystical Persian bird as a great honor.
For the first time in a couple of years, the International Fajr Film Festival started with a lavish opening ceremony. The ceremony was held on January the 31st with all the glitz and glamour.
The 42nd Fajr International Film Festival kicked off in the Iranian capital Tehran with an address by the Minister of Culture, who pointed out that the victory of the Islamic Revolution is considered a turning point in the history of Iranian cinema. He also added that the festival has created a platform for a new generation of filmmakers and actors. Traditionally, the opening ceremony has always been an opportunity to honor the veteran filmmakers of Iranian cinema, and this year was no different. Mohammad Reza Ali Quli, Parviz Sheikh Dadi, Abul Fazl Pur Arab, and Fariba Kosari received Lifetime Achievement Awards. The best poster and the best trailer of last year's movies also received the top award of the festival, the Crystal Seymour.
Unlike many other international film festivals in the world, movies that enter the Fajr Film Festival, particularly in the national section, have not been screened before. most festivals, movies are eligible to enter only after their first screenings. All that said, in Iran, the Fajr Film Festival is actually a platform for movie premieres. That is basically why the festival is so important for filmmakers. The festival is like a launchpad, because the public screenings for the movies are scheduled after the festival, and how the movies are received by the critics and the media coverage of the festival can immensely affect the gross earnings. Now, the next year after Fajr Film Festival begins, the best promotional materials, including movie posters and trailers, are chosen by the jury. The best short movie and the best documentary films also received the top prize, the Crystal Simorgh. So it is customary to have an award ceremony during the opening of the festival where all of the movies that have been screened compete and the best promotional items receive prizes. I'm honored to have received the Crystal Simorgh for the best trailer this year. Of course, I should add that this is my third Crystal Simorgh from the Fajr Film Festival over the past 5 years.
The Fajr Film Festival is a time for movie premieres, and this is because, according to regulations, movies can enter the festival only if they haven't been screened before. So, this is both exciting and challenging for movie makers who are entering the competition. Mr. Najafi, please tell me more about the Fajr Film Festival. How many movies were received and how many were selected?
The 42nd Fajr Film Festival has kicked off, and it is the second year in a row that the international section is being held alongside the national section. You may remember that the international section used to be held separately in April, but now it is the second year that the international section is held in February. Altogether, we received 621 movies for 87 countries this year. The international section includes three different competitions, including East and Vista for movies from West Asia, and two other sections called Cinema Salvation and the Festival of Festivals. But there are two additional sections this year. One is dedicated to movies about Palestine, and the other is for movies that we received through the Shanghai Film Association. In the national section, we received 106 movies, out of which 33 movies were selected to compete in the national section. As usual, the movies that have been selected will be screened over the course of 10 days, from the 1st till the 11th of February. On the 11th of February, we will hold the award ceremony to announce the winners of this year's festival.
Please tell me, how important is the Fajr Film Festival and how does it stand in an international scale?
The Fajr International Film Festival is holding its 42nd edition and dating back nearly half a century. It is considered one of the oldest film festivals in the region, and it is also known as one of the most important and best festivals in the West Asia region. Both the international and national sections of the festival are among the top film festivals of Asia and occupy a very special place in the film industry. The movie market on the sidelines of the festival also dates back 25 years and is considered one of the oldest film markets in the region. Every year, many Iranian and foreign filmmakers and distributors sign up to take part in the movie market. Not to mention that, just like this year, hundreds of movies are sent to the secretariat of the Fajr Film Festival, while many filmmakers and directors also sign up to take part and watch the movies. We've had quite a number of well-known movie directors participating in our festival over the past years. This includes Mustafa Al-Aqad, Oliver Stone, and others. I only named a few, but this shows how important the festival is and how it is perceived by high-caliber filmmakers. This year, we have dedicated a special section to Palestine. Considering the recent developments in the region and the atrocities committed against the oppressed people in Gaza, we added this section to the festival. We have scheduled to screen some really good movies that were made recently, and we have some extensive plans for this recently added section. Movies made by filmmakers from all over the world will be screened. We also have some special guests that are participating in this section, and they will be present here during the festival. In conclusion, I have to say that cinema is a tool that can deliver the message of these filmmakers in a loud voice and tell the story of what is really happening there in Gaza and depict the horrible atrocities.
Please tell me, how long will it take for the festival to end, and how will it finish?
I'll tell you about the international section, because the national sections will continue until February 11th. Of course, you know that it started on February the 1st. The international section will begin on the 6th of February. The film market will also open at the same time. All of these sections will be running until the 11th of February. That is, when the closing ceremony will be held in both national and international sections, and the winners will be announced, and the winner will receive the top prize.
You've probably noticed that I've been saying FAJ International Film Festival. In case you're wondering, yes, it's because movies from all around the world can enter this festival. Tell us more about the international section. When will it begin? And how many movies did you receive, and how many were selected?
So the international section of 42nd edition of International FAJ Film Festival will start from 6th to 11th of February. And we have three main sections. It's the Cinema Salvation, it's the international competition part. The Eastern Vista is the focus on Asian and Islamic countries, and also Festival of Festivals, and two other sections. One is the Belt and Road Initiative, and the Alliance of Different Film Festivals along the Silk Road. There is a special section and a special focus on Palestine under the name of Palestine Breath and Soul. And these are the five main sections that we have in our festival. As I mentioned, the festival will start from 6th to 11th. We did receive around 642 movies from 78 countries, and we did select from, we will have 35 films along the selections of different sections of our festival.
Could you be more specific about the different competitions in the international section?
To be more specific, maybe I explained it before, but we selected our movies with a special regard on the new international relation that we started, especially focus on Asia countries. Therefore, we do have different countries with the Eastern Vista, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan. Maybe they are a little bit not so familiar for the Iranian audience, but they move forward and they made great films during the last year. So we did select from this country so that we have a, you know, more diverse selection of the films from all around the world. So I think that's something specific for the FAJ Film Festival, giving the opportunity for different filmmakers, our neighbors, and also our regional partners to present their productions on this international scene.
Please tell us more about the participants. Tell me which countries are they from, and are there any prominent names among them?
So if I may start from the end of the question and answer that, the FAJ International Film Festival is among the 12th most important film festival in the world. You know for sure the association for a board association of producers, the FIAP. We are among the 12 most important and most influential film festival in the world, along with the Berlinale, Cannes Film Festival, Venice Film Festival, Warsaw Film Festival, Shanghai Film Festival, and now the FAJ International Film Festival is a prestigious and very important film festival in the region, and internationally, of course. Therefore, we do have a lot of guests from all around the world, from South America, from Europe, from Asia, also from the regional neighbors. And so it's a very encounter of diverse cultures, if I may say so, that the FAJ International Film Festival will host them and give them the opportunity to meet each other and also get deeper in discussion, not only artistic discussion and also the artistic collaboration. Also, we, as you may know, we do have our 25th edition of the film market, international, the Iranian International Film Market, which gives also the opportunity for producers, distributors, and also film companies to have their production on our film market, present their production, and seeking also new collaboration and new potentials for further collaboration for in the field of film production. So that's what we are combining, the economic part and the business part of the movie productions, and also the artistic part. And this is a unique opportunity for all of the film activists to be a part of our film festival.
How important is this festival on an international scale?
So, as it's the 42nd international film festival, in the FAJ International Film Festival, it's the 42 years ago they started with a very initial idea to have a national film festival at the beginning, and later on, I think in the third or fourth edition, it was the international section beside the national one. And I think in 2018 or 2016, the international part was separated, and it was a own film festival. For five or six edition, the both part, the national part and the international part, were separated. And but last year, we had the reunion of the film festival, the national part and the international awards were organized at the same time. And there were some obstacles to organize everything because, you know, to combine both festivals is a little bit difficult and complicated. But for our foreign guests, it's important to see also the Iranian movies. And so as we do have the brand new Iranian movies on our film festival, so it's a direct connection that the representative of film festivals and distributors get the opportunity to watch the films directly and choose them for their film festival and for their events. So that's the opportunity that we can provide them for this recombination of the both section of the film festival.
Movie lovers out there, there's a special segment in our show where a movie critic talks about the different movies of the FAJ Film Festival. Mr. Purkhove, thank you for the interview. Well, we all know that this is the 42nd FAJ International Film Festival, and it's been a couple of years since the international section has been added to the original festival itself. Please tell me, what are the international aspects, and
How has it influenced the national part of the festival?
Well, the Fajj Film Festival was established in 1983. This was considered an important step for Iranian cinema. The festival was national back then. A couple of years later, the international section was added.